From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan's Democratic Party chairman reviews the disastrous election of 2014 and looks ahead to 2016.
Look, we lost. We lost way too many races. We recognize that. But we have to understand what worked and what didn't and move forward.
2 years ago, Great Britain was in the midst of its worst measles outbreak in 18 years.
It's not like smallpox. This isn't a disease that has been eliminated from the world. This is one of the most infectious diseases around.
What we can learn from the UK measles outbreak and the ups and downs of working men and women trying to get through their lives. That's Your Life Idyllic, a new collection of short stories from writer Craig Bernier.
Each one of the characters has an idea of what groundedness and happiness is. They may not be existing in that, but they strive.
But first, the news. New data from Michigan Radio and public sector consultants finds Michigan voters grade their local schools better than schools statewide. I'm Cynthia Canty. We'll dig into the results on today's Stateside. And then, 2 years ago, Great Britain was in the midst of its worst measles outbreak in nearly two decades.
It's not like smallpox. This isn't a disease that has been eliminated from the world. This is one of the most infectious diseases around.
What we can learn from the UK later in the show. But first, Michigan Democrats held their party's convention over the weekend. The mission? Choose their top leader and figure out how to win come election 2016. Choosing the leader was easy. Chairman Lon Johnson had no competition for the top spot. What to do in 2016 is the challenge. Johnson is with us now. Lon, what was the feeling at the convention?
You know, we were thrilled that we had our victories, but we lost too many races out there. You know, we were looking forward and trying to figure out what we need to do as a party to win in 2016 and as importantly, win in 2018.
Well, about the only thing you could celebrate out of that 2014 election was Gary Peters being sent to the U.S. Senate. And other than that, those Republican candidates pretty much trumped yours across the board. What do you think went wrong for the party last November? Was it the message? Was it the crop of candidates?
One, you know, as a party and our candidates, we need to recognize that we need to show the people of Michigan precisely how we're going to create a state where they can stay and succeed. That means bold ideas, but it also means ideas that are spelled out in detail to them, again, precisely how we're going to stay, how they can stay here and succeed. Now, broadly, Democrats believe that to do that, we need to invest in and protect our greatest assets, our people, our land, our Great Lakes. You know, while Republicans, what we hear out of them continuously is, you know, well, if you just invest in business, everything will take care of itself. So we have a great opportunity here to show the state precisely what we mean by that. Again, broadly, Democrats believe in investing in people, and Republicans believe in investing in business. We think we have the, you know, the better way forward. But until we show the voters precisely what we mean by that, we're going to continue to lose.
Your comment that you had just said about what Democrats stand for and what Republicans stand for, there seemed to have been a lot of that over the weekend. Is that the strategy to take when it was very clear last November that a huge majority of voters are buying what the GOP is selling?
Well, I'll give you a prime example. This governor gave a $1.8 billion tax break to businesses and corporations using our money under the idea that it would create jobs. Well, first off, it just didn't do that. But secondly, the voters need something to compare that to. We can't just be the party that hates Republicans or hates Governor Snyder. We have to show them an alternative of what that $1.8 billion could be used for. Ideas like helping to pay off college loans. I've heard a lot of policies discussed. For every year a student stays in Michigan, the state could pay off an eighth of their college loan, thinking that after 8 years, that college loan's paid off, but more importantly, that college graduate is staying in Michigan. Think about what happens in those 8 years. They buy a home, they progress in a career, they get married, they have children. We have to show the people of Michigan precisely what they're going to get when they vote, if they give the Democrats the privilege of governing. I think too often we didn't do that.
So the message wasn't as clear and spelled out as it should have been.
Correct. We need to go out there and, again, in detail, show the people of Michigan how we're going to create a state that they can succeed in. And I don't believe we did enough of that.
What does the battle plan consist of then? How do you go about attacking that problem? As you say, we must do more to win. So what's that battle plan for the more?
Three things. One, we have to determine, you know, there are five distinct areas that we have to do that in. Education, economic, infrastructure, natural resources, and equality. We're putting together various groups to come up with the maybe two to three major bold policy initiatives under each one of those five issue areas. And then we have to set about working to get those items passed at the legislature or even at the local level. And once voters start to see that, I think there'll be a clear distinction between us and the Republicans, but again, in a positive way. Second thing we need to do is we need to get local. You know, we have 5,000 some precincts in the state of Michigan, and within each of those precincts, there are issues that we can contrast ourselves with the Republicans. For example, they were talking about drilling in Rochester Hill and Zio Township and Shelby Township. We didn't even touch those issues. You know, in the UP, you have a highly relevant issue there with energy. They've got a problem up there with their electric service. There are issues out there, whether it's an eyesore of a junkyard or an abandoned house or a contaminated creek. There are issues that are moving within each of these precincts that we are not showing the voters locally what they get when they vote for the Democrat either. We've got to do a better job of understanding locally, and we need to show them what the Democratic position would be.
And then you said there were three?
Yeah, the third is we need to continue building our party. You know, we took our party membership from 14,000 to 21,000. We took our emails from 100,000 to 500,000. We need to keep going. We made great gains at the Democratic Party for our party infrastructure. We need to continue on. You know, another prime example is we took our absentee voting and increased it by 45% among Democratic voters. And we have to recognize what we did right this year. You know, we elected the only new United States Democratic senator in the entire country. You know, we elected 7 of the 8 ed boards, which tells us we had more Democrats voting straight ticket than Republicans voting straight ticket. Look, we lost. We lost way too many races. We recognize that. But we have to understand what worked and what didn't and move forward. You know, everything that we did in 14, you know, we knocked 2 million doors. We had 45 offices and so forth. We've got to do that and more. And the question is, what is the more? And that's what we're working through right now.
Len, there was no talk for or against at the convention about the upcoming road funding proposal vote in May. Mm-hmm. Why was that?
Mm-hmm. First off, it's a reflection of the disorganization of that campaign. Here you had the thought leaders of the entire Democratic Party statewide all in a room, and there was just no information, nobody there talking about the issue. So that's, first off, a reflection of, I think, how poor this campaign is being run. Second, we are just now starting to review those, the ballot initiative, and the party has not made a decision on what it will do or how it's going to go about evaluating or making the decision to either support or go against it or remain neutral.
Looking ahead at the next couple of years, Lon, with this Republican mm-hmm. majority of Congress and then, of course, in Lansing,
yeah.
How do Democratic legislators advance their ideas and advance their agendas in the face of that GOP majority?
It starts with good candidates. We've got to get good candidates, hardworking, honest community leaders in their own right. There are thousands of people out there right now that are creating the state where we can stay and succeed. They've transcended, you know, the tired, old, false choice of jobs versus the environment or labor versus business or suburb versus city. They're out there creating solutions on their own right now. We've got to find those folks. And instead of asking them to join us, we need to join them. We need to help them in what they're doing and show them how politics can be relevant to the work that they're doing and encourage them to be engaged, whether it's to run for office or to join the party or to help our candidates.
Well, what about the folks who are elected and are in office right now and they're facing this big Republican majority? What are they going to do to try to get those Democratic ideas to the forefront and get them through?
Well, you know, we've got legislators, obviously, in the Senate and the House. They can introduce legislation and they can work with this governor. You know, in an odd way, both Jim Ananick, our new Senate leader, and Tim Grimmel, our leader in the House, their hands in some ways have been strengthened because of the quality of the, you know, the Tea Party Republicans that have entered into this legislature. In some ways, this governor can't even work with his own side. He's got a deadlocked Tea Party constituency. And so in many ways, I think this governor will need Democratic votes if we don't have the ability to express our ideas and I think have a bit more leverage. That's one way. But, the bottom line, we have to win. We have to go out there and show the people of Michigan what they're getting, whether it's through legislation this year or through communication to the voters directly.
Lon, looking at 2016, for Democrats, it does seem like it's pretty much Hillary Clinton's to lose as far as the big nomination. And as chair of the Democratic Party in Michigan, are you okay with what some are calling a Democratic coronation for Clinton?
Well, it's hardly a coronation. You know, first off, she hasn't even decided to run yet or not. But in looking at it, if should Hillary get in, I would have a hard time, and I'm a student of history, looking back where we would have a nominee that isn't more qualified. her work as First Lady in Arkansas to the work that she did as First Lady in the United States, then her work as a senator, then her work as a Secretary of State. I just have a hard time seeing how we could build a better candidate. She is qualified, and she has the ability to go out there and tell people precisely what she's going to do with our country should she become president. We just have a terrific candidate, Hillary Clinton, should she decide to do it.
Do you think there should be other candidates to throw their hats in? I mean, what does it mean if there are no other candidates?
Well, I think it's more of a reflection of Hillary's strength than a weakness of our party.
And if the 2016 election brings another solid trouncing for your party, which is everything you don't want to see, then what?
Michigan has voted for a Democratic president for the last six of the last six elections. And it's because we worked hard and we won those races. Now, this will be no different. We will have to work hard to get Hillary or whoever our Democratic nominee elected. The odds favor us. We have a higher turnout. And we know that when higher turnout comes, the values of Michigan are better reflected. And those values are Democratic values.
Lon Johnson, the newly reelected chair of the Democratic Party in Michigan. Lon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That music even sounds cold, and for good reason. We are shivering from the UP to Grand Rapids to Detroit and all parts in between. This cold snap is something. The National Weather Service said the Arctic blast sent the mercury plunging to minus 19 in Newberry in central UP. Port Huron, 26 below. Flint broke a record low level at 21 below this morning. Detroit Metro Airport checked in with 9 below, and that matched a record that was set back in 1904. Think about this. The normal high this time of the year is in the 30s. And we won't see any relief soon. The National Weather Service says this deep freeze will last through the week with an especially deep dive Thursday night. Still to come, the ups and downs of working men and women in Michigan, trying to get through their lives, sometimes succeeding, sometimes not. That's Your Life Idyllic, a new collection of short stories.
Nuclear physicists and folks at Flip Burgers, they have a lot of the same concerns. They have a lot of the same boredom often in jobs.
We talk with Michigan-born writer Craig Bernier. That story comes up in 10 minutes on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Still to come, Michigan voters grade our state's schools. Our latest Michigan Radio PSC poll will break down the numbers on education coming up. But first, there has been one confirmed case of measles in Michigan. Nationwide, the Centers for Disease Control is putting the number of outbreaks at 121. But it's certainly not just the U.S. dealing with measles. 2 years ago, the United Kingdom was in the midst of a major measles outbreak. BBC News health editor James Gallagher is here now from London. James, it's very good to have you with us.
Absolute pleasure.
When and where did this UK outbreak begin?
This started in Wales, in the south of Wales, and it turned into the largest outbreak in 18 years. It was more than 2,000 cases by the time it was all wrapped up, and it spread to other locations, areas in the northeast and the northwest of England as well. And this all tied down to those being pockets of places that had very low levels of MMR coverage.
So where had coverage been? How high had rates been before the British medical journal Lancet published that famous study by British Dr. Andrew Wakefield linking the MMR vaccine with autism? That was published in February of 1998. So how did that hit the levels of vaccination?
Well, let's go 2 years earlier. In 1996, vaccination rates were 92%. Now, it wasn't just one moment in 1998 when that report came out. It was sustained media pressure and arguments around MMR that lasted for years. I don't know if you're aware of it, but that Prime Minister at the time, Tony Blair, he refused to say whether his newborn son had had the MMR vaccine or had had three separate jabs instead. And so over that time, it dropped to below 80% in 2003. Since then, it has been climbing. And right now, we're at record levels. It's higher than 92%. But there was that great drop. And that has left this generation of children that have a much lower level of protection against measles than people either side. And I say 80%. In some areas, the vaccination rate dropped as low as 50%.
That is a lot of unvaccinated children. And then, of course, here on this side of the pond, we saw actress Jenny McCarthy, who told Oprah Winfrey, and I quote here, "The University of Google is where I got my degree from." She wrote a book, took up the anti-vaccine banner from Andrew Wakefield. And I think a lot of people who are, you know, debating this question and wondering, should I have my child vaccinated, forget what happened to Andrew Wakefield and his study.
Yes, well, in 2010, Andrew Wakefield was struck off the General Medical Council. Now, in the UK, that's the body that allows you to practice medicine. If you're struck off there, you're not a doctor in this country. And that was what happened to him personally. I mean, professionally, the science that he based that study on was slowly but surely completely torn apart in this country. And that's probably one of the reasons why the vaccination rate went up again, because no longer was the core argument being that maybe MMR is damaging to children. Those claims were rubbished, and it all came good again in the end.
I'm wondering, as the outbreak was kind of really ballooning in 2013 and 2014, James, did public health groups try to, for lack of a better way to put it, make the most of this outbreak to push vaccination?
They did. They really did. You know, right on the back of a lot of media attention covering the largest measles outbreak in 18 years. So what was launched was a catch-up campaign. They calculated the figure. They reckoned there were 1 million unvaccinated schoolchildren in the UK. So the plan was then that they would go out, get all the doctors to get in touch with everybody, you know, that was in their surgery books, and see if they'd been fully vaccinated. And if they weren't, go out and proactively vaccinate people. So they used the outbreak as a great PR tool, really, to actually try to boost those unvaccinated school children.
One of the debates that's happening here amongst the medical establishment, and I wonder if it happened there too, were doctors who have to decide whether to fire patients or keep them on, even if they haven't been vaccinated. I know we spoke with one pediatrician who said, well, if I fire them, I can't try to win them over and explain why they should have that. But there are physicians who are saying, we won't take your child if he or she is not vaccinated. Was there a similar debate there?
No, I think this is one of those distinctions that you get between the United States and the UK when it comes to vaccination policy. If a patient refuses to have a medical treatment, then they refuse to have the medical treatment, and that's their right, and they won't get struck off a GP's books because of that. It's a similar thing with schools. I mean, there is no compulsion here in the United Kingdom. For, you know, a pupil doesn't have to be vaccinated before they're allowed to come into school. It's not, you know, a requirement. So there are subtle differences. The people in the UK say that their method, they like it because it requires a consensual relationship between patient and doctor. It isn't about cracking the whip and saying, you know, we won't see you unless you're vaccinated. You can't come into school unless you're vaccinated. It's all about trying to convince them in a more consensual way. And the argument here is that they get children vaccinated at a much younger age, you know, in their first year of life, rather than a rush of vaccination, say, just before schools start.
With the outbreak, the worst outbreak in 18 years in the UK, in the rear view mirror, do you think, James, there are any lessons that we could take away here in Michigan from what happened in the UK?
Well, I think the lesson is not just for Michigan, it's for the whole of the world, is that measles hasn't gone away. I mean, the assumption was that, you know, measles, that's something our great-great-great-great-great-great, I'm going to run out of time so I can say great-grandparents
right.
dealt with. You know, it's not something that's a problem for today's children. This showed that, actually, it's not like smallpox. This isn't a disease that has been eliminated from the world. This is one of the most infectious diseases around, and if you don't vaccinate your children and enough other people make the same decision, then it will come back.
James Gallagher, health editor for BBC News. Good to talk with you, James. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
I'm stupefied, both giddy and repulsed, as Madonna struts, toe rings clicking against the pergo flooring, to the space on my right.
That's writer Craig Bernier reading from his collection of short stories titled Your Life Idyllic.
She removes her ball cap, shades, and outer top to reveal a torso, arms, and shoulders that only personal trainers, live-in gurus, and private chefs can incite. If I remember straight, I think Madonna is close to late 50s Jackie in age. But looking between the two of them, Jackie's big rump splayed out while she huffs into a sort of forward bend, and then Madonna makes me think perhaps two phylum exist for Homo sapiens, upper and lower.
Craig Bernier was born in Michigan, went to school at Macomb Community College, then Wayne State University, and he now lives in Pennsylvania. So good to have you with us on Stateside, Craig.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
You may live in Pennsylvania now, but boy, your Michigan roots run so strong through your writing. And I'm wondering, how would you describe your life idyllic, this collection of short stories?
I mean, I would consider there's 9 stories total, 7 of which are based in and around the Detroit metropolitan area. And it's mostly residents in Macomb County, Wayne County, and Oakland County in conflict with problems and the tensions that come of those problems and following them to see, can they get some resolution in their life and how do they cope with these problems at the onset? But very ordinary things. Your 14-year-old daughter doesn't speak English to you anymore. Instead, she takes up French and only wants to speak French, or working a night shift at Rouge River Foundry and a snowstorm hits. Very ordinary things that folks can somewhat identify with.
Oh, I completely agree. I thought every story had people who are so everyday and so relatable, and it strikes me basically they're trying to be happy and they're trying to make things work, but sometimes they fall short. In other words, they're kind of reaching for that idyllic life.
Yeah, that's sort of the irony of the story is it's hard to maybe find an idyllic life in this book. But yeah, you're right. I think that each one of the characters has an idea of what groundedness and happiness is. They may not be existing in that, but they strive.
Craig, you write in your short stories, in your life idyllic, you write with such detail and such ease about a lot of kinds of people and many kinds of jobs and challenges, from a worker at Ford's Rouge plant who's really getting sucked into and trapped into his dad's blue-collar life, or a guy trying to get his brother into rehab before that brother drinks himself to death, or a truck driver who has just had it up to here as he's stuck in a traffic jam on the west side of Detroit. And the detail, like, for example, the truck driving detail, I learned a lot about what it takes to drive a big rig. What kind of background do you bring to your writing? You've had a lot of different jobs.
I've been a worker all my life. I've done a number of different jobs. I mean, I think one of the writer's key jobs is to be a good observer, a student of life. So I don't necessarily have to be a truck driver to sit out at a truck stop and watch truck drivers, how they talk, what they do, have conversations with people about their jobs and their occupations, and listen to what it is that they say. And as a result of that, it gives me kind of carte blanche to work any job. I just need to find someone who does it and then pay close attention to what they say. And what I found is most people's jobs are pretty much alike.
No matter what they are, you're right.
Nuclear physicists and folks that flip burgers, they have a lot of the same concerns. They have a lot of the same boredom often in jobs. Work is a big part of all my stories. I mean, for me and everyone I knew, work was a kind of universal thing. We were all doing it or trying to do it or find somebody who had it. I'm a big fan of Philip Levine, and I'm always thinking of that Philip Levine poem, What Work Is.
But then there was one story that really I thought was so unique and different and relatable, and that is the one you started reading at the beginning of our interview, Lucky Star, this guy who's going to yoga class, and oh my God, who is that next to me? It's Madonna. Can you tell us a little bit about how that story idea hatched in your head?
Sure, as best I can. You know, I don't write with a real, this will sound weird, I don't write with a kind of intent to tell a story about a Madonna or yoga clinic. I tend to try to create characters enough so that when I start to follow them around in a short story, they begin to tell me, like, what it is they want to do and what it is that they want to say. It's almost a point where I become a kind of observer. So I know that I started to take some yoga classes myself, and there was all this talk about peace and centeredness, and I just found myself competing with everybody, trying to out-yoga the person next to me. And I knew that was not very yogic.
Right, it's not.
So,
but very understandable.
Right, right. And so I created this character just enough based on my own experiences to see how absurd could this get? How farcical could it get? So the next thing seemed to be introduce a celebrity into this character's life. And I don't know, I guess I was retrospectively listening to a lot of Madonna at that point, and there she popped up into this yoga studio in Clarkston, Michigan.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with writer Craig Bernier. His collection of short stories is called Your Life Idyllic. This book, winner of the St. Lawrence Book Award, which is, Craig, what helped your collection get published. And you certainly had a pretty twisty-turny road to becoming a published author. Where did you grow up?
Actually, I grew up in a small town. It was a village back then. It's different now. North of Mount Clemens, a place called New Haven, Michigan, which is a really neat place to grow up because it was strangely both industrial. There was this big foundry in the center of town and a lot of old houses. Pretty large African-American population for being in upper Michigan farmland. And then it had this agrarian farm lifestyle based right around it. So it was sort of this clash of great cultures, farmers and factory workers, all within a town space. So New Haven, Michigan is where I hail from.
And you went to the Navy right after high school in 1989 because...
Oh, I wanted to get out of Michigan as fast as possible. Who doesn't at that age? This was a day and age before everybody was running off to college. I wanted to do something different. Most of my friends joined the service, and it seemed like the thing to do. I was a bit of a joiner back then. So a buddy of mine and I joined the United States Navy in 1988, and we're on delayed entry and went in 89. And I spent about 4 years in the Navy and then 4 years in the reserves out at Selfridge Air Force Base.
You were there for Operation Desert Shield and Operation Desert Storm. Your timing was like almost bullseye, wasn't it? Were you involved in all of that?
I was on the USS Louisville, a fast attack submarine in the Red Sea during that period.
What's your main memory from that period?
You know, there are a lot greater war writers than I, and I don't spend a lot of time writing about that. I still haven't fully processed it. But I do think when people write about a war and conflict, I agree with them in the fact that it is 95% waiting and boredom and 5% unimaginable busyness, the frantic.
Huh. Did that help kind of congeal this idea that maybe you would like to write? Was it through that or after that?
No, I ran into a professor of English who was working at Macomb Community College. In one of my last classes at Macomb Community College, this professor, who's now at Saginaw Valley, his name is Vince Simarco, and he came to me outside after a writing class, and he said, "What are you doing here?" And I thought, well, I'll leave. And he said, "No, you just got a lot of talent. You don't really belong in this class. I want you to consider that you have enough talent that perhaps you could pursue this. Maybe not as a career, but just some way to make sense and meaning out of your life." And he sent me to Wayne State to work with a professor, a guy now deceased named Chris Leland. And I did that. Then the rest was just being passed off from mentor to mentor.
And then you finally get that award for your collection of short stories, the St. Lawrence Book Award, which led it to be published. One of the stories that really got me, because I'm the mother of a daughter, was An Affliction of Starlings. And this is a divorced dad doing his darndest to try to connect with that 14-year-old daughter. Number one, she's entered her teen years, so been there, enough said that. Two, she is besotted by all things French. And three, he's got to make these connections work while he's having his weekly visitation. And I got the feeling that so many people could feel what this guy is going through. So would you end by reading us an excerpt from An Affliction of Starlings?
Absolutely. This is from Affliction of Starlings. The daughter's name is Roxy, and the father is, they're sitting down to their morning breakfast routine, and they've just had a bit of an argument. "Where has this laughter gone? Lately, it's been all pouty frumping, shoulder shrugging, and poo-pooing everything I say or suggest. I glance at her, raising a brow in query, but she confuses my investigation with something else. Okay, she says, then snorts. I'll stop. She keeps giggling. Then her cellular beeps. She pulls it from a back pocket and begins with the swipes, pecks, wipes, and taps that compromise so much of our time together now. A smile lingers as she works the screen. I'm sure she's not planning on finishing her food. She turns, snaps a picture of me, then goes on typing. flips to show me grumpy on Twitter and Facebook. The caption reads, "Dad with grimace." It has already been liked, already retweeted.
Craig Bernier's collection of short stories is titled Your Life, Idyllic, and that was an excerpt from the story An Affliction of Starlings. Craig, so good to talk with you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. It's been such a pleasure. Take care.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. Still to come, we dig into schools and education in the just-released Michigan Radio Public Sector Consultants poll. And then, in 10 minutes, the next idea. We'll hear about how technology is giving customers the power to get companies to work for us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michiganders are giving their local schools higher grades than schools statewide. That's just one result from Michigan Radio and Public Sector Consultants' latest poll data. This year, Michigan Radio and PSC are teaming up, asking voters about policy issues affecting their lives. It's a series we're calling Michigan's Pulse. Jeff Williams is CEO of Public Sector Consultants, and he joins us once again. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. And this week, we focus on education. We asked voters to give their local public pre-K through 12 education system a letter grade. And what did we find?
Well, we found a kind of a similar story to what we find when we ask people about their congressperson, meaning that their local school, they think, is doing well. About 61% of respondents gave their local schools an A or a B. But when we switch and ask what grade would you give all of Michigan's K-12 schools put together, that supports drops to about in the 35% range. So again, people grading their local public schools much higher than the statewide system of public schools.
And we know that Michigan voters consistently list K through 12 education as a high priority for state spending, but here it seems they're not necessarily consistently happy with schools statewide, I guess not happy with what they're getting for their tax dollars.
That could be, and this is something we've seen throughout the years. We did questions, similar questions to this, where we said just an overall question, rate the statewide schools, and the rate very specifically schools that respondents' children attended. This was, 10 and 15 years ago. Similar story, that people always rate not only their schools higher than the schools in the state, but respondents typically rate elementary schools as a whole higher than middle schools and higher than high schools. So you see support kind of dropping for education or support of kind of how the outcomes are as you move to a statewide view of the world and also as you move from kindergarten up to 12th grade.
Why do you think this is?
I think part of it could be just distance from the school. One of the things we noticed was that younger respondents gave more A's and B's than respondents who are retired. So again, the younger respondents are far more likely to have had either recent direct experience with the schools or children in schools right now. I also think it's very hard for people to get a good sense of where the state is as a whole. So you're reflecting that when you interact with your local public school, you think things are well because you can see it. When you're left to think about the state as a whole, you have to basically judge against what you see in the news, what you see in the media. And sometimes that's an accurate picture, and sometimes you're just reacting to the last story that you saw.
And what you say about older respondents tending to give lower grades almost strikes me like that Paul Simon song, Kodachrome, that, back in my day,
this is how we did it, and it was better. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that's true. It's just that Kodachrome makes it look better.
Right, and I think it there are very few things in public life where everyone has not only has an opinion but has direct experience with, and K-12 education is one of them. You know, everyone went through some version of a kindergarten through 12th grade school, regardless of kind of country of origin or nationality, and they have strong opinions. Part of it, too, is I think you're seeing a lot of reflection from our questions last week where we talked about where should Michigan invest and where should we cut. People are still very nervous about jobs. If you're nervous about jobs, that can kind of cross over and taint your opinion of an education system where you're worried about whether the students graduating can make it in the modern world.
You touched on this at the beginning of our discussion and our conversation, Jeff, about the fact that we see this happening elsewhere. We see voters rating, you know, their local districts higher than schools statewide. We think about Congress, where voters want to kick everybody out of D.C., but nah, my hometown person is all right. Is it almost that we just kind of confer this kind of immunity to our immediate world?
I think it's more a reflection of the complexity of the modern world. It's very, very tough to get a view of the statewide system of education in Michigan. And if you look hard at the data, you get the answer that honestly, we're average. We're not greatly above and we're not greatly behind. We're just basically at the national average. Well, it's really hard to get passionate about being average. You know, Lake Wobegon didn't say that all the children are average. It said all the children are above average. So these kinds of passions are really inflamed when things are really high or really low. And it's really complex to get a view of where the nation is as a whole when you're judging Congress, or where an entire state school system with about 1,400,000 students are. It's tough to get a good measure of that.
Jeff, what is the takeaway for educational leaders in Michigan?
I think it's a twofold takeaway. One is, in general, I'm not worried by this sentiment. We've seen it echoing for the last 20 years. There are some demographics, though, that give me great pause. For example, African American voters are far more critical of their local schools. Only 40% gave an A or a B, compared to 64% of white voters. By the same token, African Americans were far more likely to give their local schools a D or an F, meaning within that average, within that response saying local schools are good on the whole, you have segments of the population, you have regions of the state very clearly today saying things don't measure up. You also see that same story when you look at the statewide education data. 77% roughly of Michigan's ninth graders graduate from high school in 4 years. Only 64% of economically disadvantaged students graduate. Only 61% of African Americans. So again, as we peel back these averages, I am concerned that we see entire populations that are not able to achieve at the state average, let alone exceed.
Concerned, but are you surprised?
No, not surprised. That's been the story of modern education since The Nation at Risk was published, going on, I guess, 30 years ago now, almost 40. We have a system of education that is wonderfully built and designed and run to provide a very good basic level of education across the board. It is being challenged now by a modern society that's moving faster and where children are not entering school at the variation in when they enter school in terms of skills and capabilities and backgrounds is far greater than it has been before. Our school systems are adapting. They are changing. They need to change faster. And again, some of the best principals and superintendents and school boards in the state would absolutely agree with that statement. But again, it's a system that has over 4,000 buildings in Michigan. It's a system that serves 1.4 million students. It's a big system that's going to take a while to change.
Jeff Williams is CEO of Public Sector Consultants. PSC and Michigan Radio are partnering in a year-long series, Michigan's Pulse, as we check in on voters' attitudes all across the state. Jeff, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Collaborative, part of the community. The next idea. When we really see each other, we want to help each other.
One of Henry Ford's most famous quotes about the Model T was, "Any customer can have a car painted any color he wants, so long as it is black." And that pretty much sums up the traditional relationship between companies and consumers. In other words, to borrow from Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. But that dynamic is changing. Today's contributor to The Next Idea thinks that we're moving towards build it with them, and they are already here. Venkat Ramaswamy is a professor of marketing and computer and information systems at U of M's Ross School of Business. It is really good to have you with us today.
Thank you.
You believe that there is a major transformation coming in the way that we approach our relationships with businesses and eventually with government and even with each other. One of the things driving this is our expectation as customers are changing a lot. What's different now?
So if you go back over the last 10 years, you've seen with the advent of the web, a lot of new ways by which people can now stay informed. It's been about 10 years since we've had YouTube. Then we have a lot of the social media tools today. The iPhone arrived on the scene in 2007.
With cameras.
That's right. And so all of a sudden, it allows individuals anywhere in the globe to not just participate, but actually express themselves in new ways. So it's not just text now, it's audio, it's video. And these are all new forms of not just interaction, but actually communication. And so it's actually changing the way people can get informed, the way they can now start to share their experiences, and actually bring their perspective of kind of value, if you will, to the table.
So we begin to expect that we can express our views and our opinions.
Yeah. So going back to the Henry Ford quote, and, you know, that was valid for the time in which we were in, which was the industrial age, where companies built goods and services, and they tried to segment markets. They thought about different variants of the products. And we were over at the other end as passive recipients of what they had to offer. And that went on for a while. And, you know, companies would do their best to try to get inputs from customers and so on. But now the whole kind of the tables have turned because all of a sudden we have customers like you mentioned in the beginning who are not only now because of these tools being able to be informed, but they can have a voice, they can express themselves. Whether or not companies hear them, there is kind of like a broad platform out there to actually share our experiences.
Just like a tiny example, when I recently took a flight and I was especially impressed with the Delta gate agent. Very impressed with how she handled things. So I tweeted at them. And I'm kind of a newbie at Twitter, but I did tweet at Delta so-and-so, gate so-and-so, and they tweeted right back. I was giving a thumbs up and I heard right back. And there was kind of a little charge that I got from being acknowledged by the big company.
Right. So now, taking your Delta example, there's a key point here, which is that this is not about us as a company or Delta, in your example, versus them, the consumer. Mm-hmm. And that's very important because it's not that the them is getting more empowered. If you step back, it is really this new opportunity where the so-called them, they have new capabilities. But the us also has new capabilities. Delta also has new capabilities. So it's really changing the way we engage with each other in a way that's not just win-win, it's win-more. And so that's at the heart of what I call co-creation, which is essentially creating this value together, but through experiences. So going back to your Delta example, Delta has done a lot today where they make a lot of things transparent, like the wait list at their monitors. The more they can do that, the less will you go up to the gate agent and keep asking for, you know, what happened to my upgrade or, you know, I want to change my seat, et cetera. So the more you can facilitate that, it actually helps the company spend less time and so they incur less cost trying to satisfy you because a lot of these things can be done using other media. And, you know, in this case, you know, through devices, especially as people now have mobiles, it offers them a channel of communication interaction. But the point is it has to be two-way. So it's not just originating from the company to the customer. It can also go from the customer to the company, but also customer to customer as well. And so the idea that communities are going to play a very important role moving forward is very important for organizations to understand.
You call this concept co-creation, and you're one of the pioneers of this idea. And in your essay, you use the example of Nike's running platform called Nike Plus Running. Give us a sense of how that works and how this really embodies your concept of co-creation.
Sure. So far we have talked about certain kinds of platforms implicitly. When you said you tweeted about your Delta experience, if you look at the company's perspective, that is in terms of the customer kind of communicating with the company and other customers. And a lot of companies are starting to do that. But in the Nike example, what is interesting, and there are lots of other similar examples, companies are also starting to change the way they think about offerings. So in the past, it was just a product or Delta would offer you the service. In the case of Nike, you know,
here's our
example
shoes.
Of here's the shoes, right?
Yeah.
Running shoes.
Yeah.
But today what they've done is they've said, well, there's the shoe. And for certain sports like soccer and basketball, you know, the shoe is a very important artifact in your sports experience. But today they also have specific apps from Nike, which help you, for example, train for that particular sport. So it's not just the shoe, it's a shoe plus. Now, they've gone one step further in the case of running, for example. What they're actually doing is offering you not just just a shoe, but saying the platform is the offering. And what do I mean by that? The platform is essentially a place where the whole community of runners can get together, so where you can interact personally or collectively. It's up to you. So, for example, you can interact with a trainer, a coach. You can interact with other runners in the mm-hmm. community. So what they're trying to do is to provide this this platform or this place, if you will, or environment might be a better word, where essentially the value comes from the interactions that people have around the running experience and kind of what it means in the context of what you're trying to do. Are you trying to train for a marathon? You know, what are you trying to accomplish? You know, what are your goals? So in that context, they provide software that helps you get more meaning out of the data. But a lot of the meaning also comes from talking to other people about it mm-hmm. and sharing it with other people.
I've seen that. A friend of mine is a runner who lives in Virginia, and I will see her, not you know, cheer me along as I run. It goes up on Facebook, and then you see her track, and I know it's through that Nike platform. What does Nike get out of this? Because it's a two-way street.
That's right. So if you go back to, again, your Henry Ford quote, mm-hmm. and even Nike has been in the same boat, Nike hasn't had the opportunity to actually interact with its customers in this kind of continuous fashion over time. If you look at the traditional model, cars were sold through dealers, then it comes to the customer. There's hardly any opportunity to interact with the customer. You've sold the car, and you know, off you go, drive the car. Mm-hmm. Same with Nike. You get the shoes, you put it through retail channels, you buy the shoe.
Might be a few focus groups just to
So it kind of ends with that kind of sale and maybe that sale experience.
Point of purchase.
Yeah, but nothing happens after that. But today, actually, it's kind of exactly the opposite. That whole space of experiences has now become kind of center stage for Nike and saying there's a lot of value that we can create mm-hmm. from there. So going back to your question, Nike can obviously keep in touch with the runners on a daily basis. They can see kind of what matters to people, assuming that they provide forums where people can share what matters to them. And so Nike does that. And there are lots of other companies like Starbucks provides a platform called My Starbucks Idea, encouraging people to share their experiences of, mm-hmm. you know, the coffee in the stores and what they would like to see. Maybe, you know, you want almond milk. So it provides this huge channel of kind of continuous inflow of what people would like.
This concept of co-creation is really in its infancy. Where do you see this going?
So I've seen this grow in terms of building, you know, what I call private, public, social ecosystems. And people are starting to tackle more complex issues using these principles. So what I see is that technology in general is kind of been facilitating this so far. And I think now that we have a critical mass of people who have mobile devices and we have some maturity in terms of the broadband infrastructure, even though still a lot of people don't have access to the internet on a regular basis mm-hmm. worldwide. But, you know, the broadband penetration is getting there.
Yeah.
You're seeing the mobile phones reach that critical mass. With the result that now you have a lot of people who are building new tools. And I think to the extent that these tools are built with this kind of thinking in mind, and I think a lot of organizations are starting to see that, I think it can help create you know, a better world in general where people can participate more, they can collaborate more, they can be informed more, and you can start to see actions being taken by organizations that connect more with what I call the human experience. Because the human experience hasn't been the center of a lot of this economic mm-hmm. activity. It's more like it's an afterthought. So like you said before, your company's products, then you know, they give you forms to fill, customer satisfaction, they're trying to connect. Now I think it's starting to change, and I think for the first time, I see the technology enabling this kind of humanization of value. Or at least that's the hope. Now, how things will turn out, you'll see.
Venkat Ramaswamy is a professor at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan, and you can find his essay on co-creation at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on co-creation. You can file those in the comments section underneath the essay or at Michigan Radio's Facebook page or, as always, on Twitter at Next Idea MI. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, and Lindsay Scullin. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.